Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen. Imagine you have a bookstore. In this bookstore, you have very limited shelf space. If you hope to make any profit, what titles will you put on the shelves? Chances are you pick the ones that will likely sell the most copies. We call these the top sellers. Now, let's imagine your bookstore is no longer a physical building, but a network of computers, and the books are digital files that don't take up any physical shelf space. Would you stock only the top sellers, or could you maybe add a heck of a lot more titles, even some really strange and obscure ones that most people will never want? Your hypothetical bookstore is an example of the kind of thing that is happening with the internet, where you as a consumer can find the strange and obscure just as easily as the top sellers. This turns out to have large implications for business, culture, media, and education, among other things. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk about the features of this phenomenon, which has come to be called the long tail, a phrase I now hear as commonplace in many conversations. Happily for us, our guest is the person who coined the phrase and articulated its meaning. Chris Anderson is the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. He first outlined the concept of the long tail in print in the October 2004 issue of Wired. The long tail piece quickly became the most cited Wired article ever. That work has now been expanded into a book, The Long Tail: Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More, recently published by Hyperion. In the book, Chris Anderson explains how the new economics of abundance is creating new opportunities for consumers and business, and shaking up pre-internet business models, among other things, rather drastically. As we talk with Chris Anderson, we invite you into the conversation. Your questions are welcome. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. If you're listening online or anywhere outside the 217 area code, you can use our toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. And Chris Anderson joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
So far, I have only hinted at, perhaps badly, the concept of the long tail. Could you begin by having you tell us how you came upon the concept?
Sure. Well, this was about 3 years ago. One of the things I'm often asked to do as the editor of Wired is to talk about technology trends and, you know, where's the world going and all that. And because I'm a proper geek, and before I was the editor, I had a background in science and economics. I tend to look to data to give the answer. And what I realize is that there's a lot of companies out there, who now the internet is 12 years old or so. There's a lot of data out there that maybe suggests what's different about culture and economics, in this digital age. And I was talking to one of them called Ecast, which is a digital jukebox company, which is like a regular jukebox, with neon and big speakers. But instead of having, 100 CDs or, God forbid, some vinyl singles, they have a broadband connection and a big hard drive. And so they can have many thousands or tens of thousands of songs. And what they asked me was, what percentage of our top 10,000 songs do you think sells at least once a month? And, this is my instinct would be like most people's to say, well, it's the 80-20 rule, right? So 20% of everything, 20% of things sell 80% of represent 80% of the sales. But maybe digital is different, so maybe it's half, but that's a lot. That would be suggesting that 5,000, the tracks sold at least once a month. If the average jukebox has maybe 200, that's a huge increase. So I said 50%. And it turns out I was just way off. The answer was 98%, and virtually all of the tracks they put out there sold. And when they went to 30,000, 40,000, 50,000, again, virtually all of the tracks they put out there sold, if not once a month and once a quarter or once a year. But there was demand for absolutely everything. And then I went looking to other companies and found the same phenomena seemed to exist, and I realized we've been looking, it was time to look past the blockbuster.
This 98% rule you describe, and it seems to extend for the entire extent of the catalog, no matter how it's expanded?
It's not always 98%, but sometimes it's 90%.
Yeah.
Broadly what we're finding is that there is extraordinary demand for niche products. It's not concentrated in any one place, and maybe no single one product sells a lot, but everything has some demand somewhere. And, when you have an incredibly efficient marketplace like the internet, where you can reach everybody everywhere for essentially no cost with digital files, you can now tap that latent demand for niche products and sort of fringy stuff, and you know, the places where all of us deviate from the mainstream in some part of our life, you can now tap that and turn it into a proper, you can finally measure the demand for that market and turn it into a proper business. And that's very much what you're seeing with the iTunes and the Amazons and the Netflixes and the eBays of the world.
Now, previous to the internet, when products were physical items sitting on shelves exclusively, you really could not provide for these niche markets. And so what you're saying is that that whole sort of economics of scarcity or of limited shelf space is out the window.
Exactly. We've assumed, I mean, the 20th century was what I call the hit-driven century. This is a century dominated by top 40 radio, blockbusters, bestsellers, and you know, it became even more dominated as you saw the rise of these national, you know, big box retail chains like Walmart. And you know, we assumed that that our culture was being increasingly dominated by hits and blockbusters because that's what we wanted. In fact, what we're realizing is that's what the distribution channels wanted. It's the most efficient way to make use of scarce shelf space. What we're now finding with these, you know, markets that have, you know, as you say, infinite shelf space, is that we can now measure what we really want. And what we want is more. We want more choice. We want more variety. We want more diversity. There's still a place for hits and blockbusters, but it's not a monopoly anymore because the shelf's big enough for everything.
This thing you talk about, one of the chapters, The Rise and Fall of the Hit, we've been obsessed with hits, it seems, especially since the broadcast age, and that's really been the focus of the entire entertainment industry, the media industry, and so forth, to the extent that it's distorted actually what people want, it seems.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because you think about hits, and you know, it's like, what's wrong with hits? I mean, they're popular, they're good, they're entertaining, and there's nothing wrong with hits. But they're not for everybody. Well, let me actually reverse that. The problem with them is that they attempt to be for everybody. The only way to get a hit is to have something of broad appeal. Mm-hmm. And things of broad appeal, there's certain compromises you have to make. Right. They need to have some certain formulas. If it's a movie, it's good to have a recognizable and very famous star. It's good to have a happy ending. It's, you know, you want to make sure that it's not, you know, rated R or B or above. It's, you know, special effects are a good thing, and, you know, action plots are even better. And so you end up sort of falling back into a relatively limited range of variety because that's what it takes to reach a lot of people. And, you know, when you think about it, like, you know, what the thing about hits is that they succeed by touching our shared interests. You know, the places where our interests overlap, and our interests tend to overlap relatively, you know, banal things like movie stars and you know, action themes and special effects.
Chase scenes and explosions. Yeah.
Chase scenes and explosions. I mean, we can all agree that chase scenes and explosions are entertaining.
Right.
Where we disagree is things like French satire or anime or things like that. And
yeah.
And the result is that you know, I may actually prefer anime to mainstream Hollywood, but in the movie theater I don't have that choice because the carrying capacity of the Megaplex network is about 120 films a year, and that's just not very many. There are, by contrast, about 13,000 films a year shown in film festivals, but only 120 of them make it out to the Megaplex. So, so the ones that make it to the Megaplex are the ones that do have those sort of lowest common denominator themes. Nothing wrong with that. You know, they are entertaining. It's just that that's not the only thing. And so, in a sense, they've had a monopoly on the distribution, channel, and now we have some competition. And that's why you're seeing such a richer variety of culture and variety and choice now out there.
We have a call to talk with. I promise I'll get right to them. But just follow up on this, the thing we were just talking about, the previous channels that sort of dominated the media landscape with, you know, this hit culture and really trying to maintain their economic space, you know, their market share and so forth. They don't like this so much. It seems that there's a lot of gnashing of teeth and sort of resistance and confusion and sort of, casting about for how do we maintain hit culture?
Yeah. Well, you know, I experienced this. I'm the editor of a mainstream, you know, a million, you know, reader magazine. I work for Condé Nast, you know, which the America, you know, which really in many ways defines blockbuster culture in the magazine industry: Vogue, Vanity Fair, New Yorker, etc.
Right. Wired is a hit. Come on.
Wired is a hit. My book is a New York Times bestseller. I mean, you know, the irony. And I very much, you know, sympathize with this. I am in the mainstream media. I've had to go from competing with a few other magazines and newspapers to competing with 27 million blogs.
Yeah.
You know, the long tail of media, as it were. And this is, you know, I think it's incredibly exciting. I think it's great for the consumer. It's a challenge for, you know, for those of us in the blockbuster business. And I don't think it's, you know, it's not the end of the hit by any means. We're still doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean that we're facing, you know, a new kind of competitor. And this is sort of, you know, an army of amateurs, you know, this sort of, you know, the million little guys out there who can focus in on niche interests in a way that we, as sort of a one-size-fits-all product, can't. So that obviously is an opportunity for us in our web strategy, which we can talk about later if you'd like.
Okay. All right. Well, let me just reintroduce our guest this morning during this hour, Focus 580, Chris Anderson. He is the editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine, a great hit magazine, by the way, Chris. I love it. And author of the book The Long Tail, Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More, recently published by Hyperion. We have one caller waiting. Would welcome others if you want to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a listener in Kankakee on line number 4. Good morning.
Lots of people are undoubtedly making big money in enterprises which involve the Internet. Your caller, however, would like to know how an ordinary bloke like this caller, who is a skilled personal computer end user and is good at queries and searches and establishing web presences, might best cash in on Internet abundance directly. And throughout this hour, would the guest please, in addition to all else, be telling this caller how this is done? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, I get this a lot. The sort of, you know, okay, well, I, you know, we can see the trend out there. We've measured the shifting culture and economy through this, you know, this lens of abundance. What does it mean for us as consumers, us as producers, us as retailers, et cetera, as mm-hmm. business people? For businesses, I mean, the main winners in the long tail market have been what I call the aggregators, and these are the big marketplaces. They are the Amazons and the Netflixes and the eBays, et cetera. And there aren't many of them, and they tend to dominate their markets, which is somewhat ironic. Although I don't think they'll last forever. But that's not available to all. So what does it mean for the producer, the small producer, who can't necessarily, you know, be an aggregator, be a marketplace for everybody? And the first answer is that, obviously it's now possible to reach a larger market than ever before. So eBay has been, you know, the best thing to the small, medium-sized business ever, because now these little companies that, you know, didn't really have access to the Walmart shelves now do have access to global markets. So that's an old story. We understand that's true. The new thing is the extraordinary power of word of mouth online, the ability to use consumers talking to each other, online on blogs and discussion groups and elsewhere, as a form of free marketing. And, you know, what you're finding is that smart businesses right now are not just advertising. They're not just, you know, hoping that the search engine on eBay is going to allow people to find them. What they're doing is that they're contacting, they're reaching out to consumers who increasingly, you know, express themselves in public on things like blogs, and they're finding those influentials. And the new influentials online are not institutions, they're not advertisers, they're not companies pushing out marketing messages. They're really sophisticated consumers who are advising other consumers on what to do. And this rise of sort of the amateur tastemaker is one of the big themes that we're seeing right now in culture and the economy. And in a sense, the power structures is almost entirely inverted online, where people trust institutions less and they trust people like themselves, other individuals and consumers a lot more. And so as a result, you know, a few negative reviews online can outweigh you know, I mean, millions of dollars of advertising is something that you can ask Dell about. And this is, you know, so that is not only a kind of a changing culture online, but it's also an opportunity to find out who those influentials are in your business, reach out to them, get them to talk about your product, and that counts as the free marketing that, in combination with, you know, the eBay presence or the web presence or whatever, can, you know, really grow a business.
Well, and it seems also to be a very democratizing force in terms of the market that, you know, a company can't just put out a bunch of hype about a product that isn't true and then
right.
not get called on it. I think, as you know, David Weinberger and others, you know, the Clutrain Manifesto, another book that, you know, a lot of people talk about as being very significant and sort of revealing the contours of, you know, really how the internet has changed how we all relate to each other online and how companies and how business, it can't be hype anymore, folks, because people are going to find out.
Exactly. They're not only, you know, see your product in the context of all the other products in the marketplace. I mean, because they're so now what we call, they're super empowered with information. You know, the day of the sort of the dumb consumer who did what they were told is gone. I mean, they, you know, just a Google search will give you more, you know, enough research on a product to be able to figure out whether it works or doesn't. But they're also they're also you know very much talking amongst themselves. So bad buzz, bad word of mouth about a product spreads even faster than good word of mouth. It's interesting, the Clutrain Manifesto, the book you mentioned, which actually came out, God, something like, what, 10 years ago?
Yeah,
quite a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Very prescient, but its main theme was that markets are conversations.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference because, you know, the old model is markets are lectures, right? We tell you what to buy and you sheep people go buy it. The new market is, you know, they're going to talk amongst themselves, and if you're authentic and have something to say, you the producer, you the company who wants to push a market, well, you can be part of that conversation, but you have to be part of the conversation on the consumer's terms, not yours, because if you're not speaking in a human voice, they just won't listen.
Yeah. I want to return a little bit to the concept of the long tail, because I think we outlined it, but just to kind of put a fine point on it and talk about what industries it applies to, you have a nice sort of detailed display of Rhapsody's music downloads. Rhapsody is another online music service that, you know, the product is digital files, folks, so there's no limit to the shelf space or, you know, well, there's hard drives, but hard drives are increasingly cheap. So there's no incremental cost for adding new tracks, right? So the point is that the tail extends. How far does it extend?
Yeah, well, you know, in the case of music, I mean, you know, the sky's the limit. You know, so right now, just to give you some points of reference, America's largest music retailer is Walmart. They have about 4,200 unique CDs in the average Walmart. That works out when you look at how many of those actually, how many of the individual tracks actually sell, that works to be about 25,000 tracks. And the reason I've just switched from albums to tracks is because the online market is a single market, and the offline market tends to be an album market. So 25,000 tracks is the inventory of the largest retailer in the land. By contrast, the online music services such as Rhapsody or iTunes have between 1.5 and 2 million tracks. The peer-to-peer services like Kazaa, you know, the file trading places like Kazaa and others have about 9 million tracks. And there's probably, you know, estimates vary, but there's probably at least 25 million tracks out there between vinyl and cassettes and live versions and remixes and things like that. And, you know, and of course, every year 65,000 new albums are released, and God knows how many of, you know, live tracks could be released if someone just wanted to record them and put them online. So, you know, it's an infinite number. And again, contrast all of that with 25,000 in a Walmart, and we're talking about, you know, extraordinary, you know, difference between the variety available online and the tiny sliver of choice available in the largest retailer in the land.
Mm-hmm. But in the online environment where people do have access to 9 million or whatever the number is, tracks, this phenomenon, the 98% rule, maybe it's not 98%, but the long tail is essentially the fact, sort of the description of that people are actually finding those tracks and consuming them.
Right, exactly. Just putting things out there isn't enough. It has to be findable. So obviously Google is a huge facilitator of the long tail by you know, driving demand to this obscure stuff through something like search, and likewise recommendations on music services. If you liked X, you might like Y, etc. Mm-hmm. Also drive demand down to the niches. We should probably actually take a minute and talk about where the term long tail comes from.
Sure.
may not be clear. The long tail refers to the long tail of the sales curve, and you have to kind of imagine a ski slope. This is kind of when you take any market and you rank the products in terms of their popularity or sales, you get this sort of ski slope shape where at the left side it's very high, and that's where the hits and bestsellers are, and then it falls off really rapidly to a long flat, you know, sort of bunny slope along the bottom that goes off, into the distance on the right. And, you know, in typical markets, you hack it off, you know, after the steep part, because that's, you know, at that point, the things don't sell well enough to justify the rent on their shelf space. But in these new markets, of course, you don't hack it off. You offer everything. And the long tail represents the long tail demand to the right, that long line that goes off into the distance that looks like it's pretty close to zero, but when you focus in and you realize it isn't. And that's where you have, you know, no single product sells a lot, but there are so many of them that they add up to a big market. And to get back to Rhapsody and the music services, and what we're finding is that about 40% of Rhapsody's business, in other words, 40% of the music download in Rhapsody, is music not available in Walmart. So that's the fastest growing part, and within 5 years, I suspect it'll be 50%. So that says that half of the online music business is music not available in the largest bricks and mortar music store in the country.
Which
that's
is not
the long tail.
Which is not what the music industry has been focusing on. Which is one reason they are kind of panicked.
Well, they're panicked for a lot of reasons. obviously Napster did them no good. The fact that music is so easily downloaded and findable. The fact that the traditional retail model is flailing. The fact that music radio is in decline. The fact that that the music press is in decline. All the traditional levers of marketing, you know, blockbuster music are starting to fail. So the music industry is in distress. What's interesting though is it's not as bad as some people think. I mean, yes, CD sales, album sales are down, but digital sales have almost made up the difference. Digital meaning tracks on iTunes or ringtones, things like that. And so, you know, the music industry for the last few years has been pretty much flat. Not down, but just flat. What's interesting is that the top 100 has been down dramatically. Mm-hmm. And the number of gold, platinum, multi-platinum albums is down more than 50% over the last 5 years, even as the industry itself in terms of revenues is pretty much flat.
We're talking this morning with Chris Anderson. He's editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine. We're discussing his book, The Long Tail, Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More, published by Hyperion. If you would like to join our conversation, 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We've so far talked about music, download tracks, digital files, and so forth. But what other industries does the long tail pertain to? What about physical goods that still require shelf space?
Sure. Well, I mean, we talked a little bit about eBay, which is clearly the long tail of hard goods. You know, if you want something that isn't available in your local, big box retailer, you go to eBay, and it's sure to be there. It's also the long tail of merchants, all those small, medium-sized businesses who aren't in your local community and aren't drivable, but are findable online. So then you can, okay, so that's physical goods and people now, or businesses in this sense. You can also think of Google as being the long tail of advertising. So all those, text ads that have turned Google into the biggest technology success story of our era are little tiny ads at 5 cents per click that wouldn't have made any sense as 30-second TV spots or glossy ads in Wired. They're ads that are sort of niche ads. They're not for everybody, but they're very highly targeted on the content that they run against or the search terms that they run against. So that's a new kind of advertising that scales down the long tail. Then you get into really sort of, much more extreme variation on this theme. Just to give you a kind of one example, Anheuser-Busch just started a new division called Long Tail Libations, named after this very theory. And the long tail beer is microbrews and craft beer and regional beer. This is a little surprising because, typically the formula of the long tail is this, that if you can lower the cost of distribution, you can offer more stuff. Now, what's lower the cost of distribution of beer? And it turns out that over the last 10 or 15 years, there has been, in part thanks to the big box retailers, there's been a revolution in supply chain management and all that. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you can actually have many more products on the shelf without the problem of, you know, of unsold inventory, you know, piling up in the warehouse. So over the last 15 years, it's actually been a doubling of products on the shelves of the typical supermarket, and that's an opportunity to have not just, you know, Pabst Blue Ribbon and Bud and Coors, but maybe, you know, 40, 60 beers, including some microbrews and regional beers that might not have been findable in your supermarket before.
Well, obviously, it's an opportunity for retailers, but it's also, it seems, a revolutionary revelation for consumers in the sense, especially if you like microbrewery beer, that you can find anything you want, basically, right now. It's available.
Yeah, this is really a consumer paradise in that you've got so much choice and so much information to allow you to make that choice wisely. You not only have information about products, but also information about pricing. You can very, very quickly decide whether this is a good price or not. It's interesting, in one chapter in the book, I talk about one of the downsides of this, and there's a book called The Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz that came out last year. And he argues that too much choice is a bad thing because it's overwhelming. And, you know, you will either like, why do I have to become an expert on jam to sort through the 300 kinds of jam here, et cetera. It's quite a compelling story, since I think we all know we've all walked into stores and realized, God, you know, where do I start? The answer is he's right, except for one thing, that yes, choice is overwhelming unless you have help. If you have help, and that help can take the form of either, you know, a very informed clerk in the store or search or recommendations online, then suddenly more choice becomes better. And, you know, just think about this. Jam is the example we all use because the only studies, you know, so the studies that people keep quoting are studies about, you know, the Stanford study about jam that they said, well, we offered people, you know, six kinds of jam and they bought a certain amount and were happy with it. Then we offered them 36 and they bought less and they were less happy with it because they were overwhelmed. They didn't want to become an expert. This is fun to go through this example because, as it turns out, Amazon does offer jam. They have 1,200 kinds of jam. And, you know, that should be overwhelming, except for there's these little tools that make things easier for you. You can rank by best-selling. If you don't know anything about jam, just rank by best-selling and pick the top one. Or you can go by customer reviews. Or you can sort of slice them by organic or light versions, et cetera. Now, I don't know how many people actually buy their jam on Amazon, but as a sort of thought exercise on how a little bit of information and some smart software can turn overwhelming choice into neatly ordered, liberating choice, that's a perfect display of it. And that's, I think, the answer to Barry Schwartz's challenge.
Well, you have a nice section on Amazon in particular, and this is another illustration of a company that is succeeding in a long tail enterprise that has books, that require shipping and all the sort of traditional physical handling of goods and so forth. I wonder if you could talk a bit about the rise of Amazon and how it is doing in this environment.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I start the Amazon discussion actually in 1896. Mm-hmm. With the Sears Roebuck catalog of the time. And Sears Roebuck was the Amazon of its day. And it rose on the back of another extraordinarily powerful network that changed the economic game. And that network was the railroad system. The railroad system allowed you to have centralized inventory in Chicago, as it happens, and then to distribute it to send products to distributed customers. They didn't have to be next to you. They could be on the farm in the Kansas prairie. And as a result, you had this incredible efficiency. You could have a large number of products in one warehouse, and then you could reach people wherever they were, and it didn't really matter. What the geography didn't matter in that instance. It slowed things down a little bit, but it didn't limit the size of your marketplace. And if you look at, you can now buy actually a reprint of the 1896 Sears Roebuck catalog, and it's an extraordinary thing. It's more than 500 pages. It's got hundreds of thousands of goods. 12 pages of tea alone. Just an amazing increase in variety variety and choice. And you just imagine, you know, contrasting that with, you know, sort of riding a horse 12 miles to the local, you know, general store, and then suddenly thump, you know, the 500-page Sears Roebuck catalog lands on your doorstep, and you're like, whoa, this is amazing. And, you know, so Amazon is that model with one big advantage, which is rather than having a paper catalog, it's a digital catalog. Now, what's better about a digital catalog? Well, aside from the fact that it's got unlimited space, not 500 pages, but 500 million pages, if you'd like, it also has findability. You can search. You can use recommendations. The catalog reorganizes and sort of adjusts on the fly to your interests. So there is no one Amazon catalog. Every one of us sees a different Amazon catalog based on our expressed interests as we click through and start doing our shopping. And that power of helping people find what they want, along with offering a lot of choice, is what's really made Amazon a sort of successful model. And now they've taken that model, you know, one step further, and rather than just having the products in a big warehouse, they actually have just become a storefront for products that are in other people's warehouses, either little stores or used bookstores and things like that. And as a result, Amazon has none of the inventory costs of these products. They just facilitate the sale, and then the product shifts straight from the third party to you, the consumer, at, you know, virtually no cost to Amazon. And now you're taking an Adams business of physical products and turning it into what looks like a digital business with all those incredible economic advantages, you know, simply by facilitating sales rather than having to store everything yourself.
We're talking this morning with Chris Anderson about his book, The Long Tail, Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More. Chris Anderson is the editor-in-chief of Wired magazine, and if you would like to join our conversation, you are welcome to do so. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. I want to talk about, ask you to talk about the implications of the long tail to news media, because this is something that I think is very, to many of us who work in the media, we see this as a very hopeful thing, but also there's a lot of concern that, you know, we hear this anxiety that, well, if there aren't any channels that everyone looks at, there's no common space where everyone gets their news, then we lose our cohesion in terms of all understanding ourselves as, you know, as a community of people who are, you know, perhaps as a democracy, we need to be looking at the same things.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a variety of things there that perhaps you could talk about. I wonder if you could address.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of, you know, let's take your last point about the sort of the loss of common culture. There's a lot of concern about this. I mean, especially now in a time where we're politically, you know, polarized and divided that way, it seems like, you know, anything that can connect us is a good thing. And, you know, say what you want about primetime television and blockbuster movies, but they at least were common culture. At least were things that many of us tended to do, if not together, at least at some point or another. So the question is, well, as we fragment, you know, as we go off doing our own things, and the water cooler effect declines, we can't assume that we all watched the same thing last night. Do we lose something as a culture? Does something that defines us as one people start to erode? And, you know, I think the answer is probably yes, a little bit. But my point is that, you know, we're gaining something as well. So when we go off and do our own things, we're not necessarily doing them alone. We're doing them with other people who share our interests, who aren't necessarily our coworkers or people, you know, at home, but they are people, some of them online, some of them in our local communities, who we have discovered because we now have these marketplaces where we can find anything we want and consumers talk about what they're interested in, so you can find people who share your interests. So I call those tribes of interest or tribes of affinity. And, you know, we're moving to a more tribal culture, one where we don't all do the same thing at the same time, but we tend to find people who share our interests, and we do things, and we you're into your music and I'm into mine. I've never heard of yours and you've never heard of mine, but that doesn't matter because I'm really into my music and I know people who share my interests. So I think you're seeing a sort of decline in mass culture and a rise in tribal culture. So is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, my sense is that, you know, what we share in mass culture, the fact that you and I both, you know, saw CSI last night, is a relatively superficial connection between us. You know, that's you know, along with the weather and, you know, how you doing, maybe it's the start of a conversation, but it doesn't take the conversation very far. If, on the other hand, you know, you find out that, you know, you're into anime, I'm into anime, have you read the latest, et cetera, that's the beginning of a much deeper conversation. So I think the trade-off is that we're losing something in some of the shallow connections between us, and we're gaining something in some of the deeper connections between not everybody, but a subset of people who do share our interests. And I suspect that that's probably a net positive, but time will tell.
Yeah, and that, you know, pertaining to entertainment and cultural products that we no longer share in common, but we have our own tribe or niche that we're interested in, is one thing. And I'm also thinking about, though, news and public affairs, because that's what we do here, you know, and we're concerned with the idea that people aren't reading newspapers. That there's no Walter Cronkite that everybody's listening to anymore. Now there's the internet, which is a marvelous tool for digging as deeply and as broadly as you want any particular issue. So on the one hand, it's very hopeful because we have the tools. You know, I mean, Google for one thing, but many other tools as well. And you know, there's so much from the news that is now archived, that if we missed the broadcast, we missed Walter Cronkite or John Stewart in this case, we can go back and get that. So there's a lot of good about it, but there's also some concern that maybe people are just not even tuning in and not aware of what's going on in the world.
Yeah, well, there is definitely in the political realm, there is definitely, you know, some concern about this. And you know, I actually talk a little bit about this. I mean, you know, the role of the newspaper used to be exactly as you say. The role of the newspaper was to be the canonical source, you know, the one authoritative place that everyone could go to get their news. And this is why they had to be balanced and impartial. And this is why the New York Times could have that, you know, that somewhat, you know, archaic slogan, "All the news fit to print," because you know that was actually the way, that was the kind of the way it saw things at the time. The reason newspapers in decline is not that we're any less interested in news; we're more interested in news. It's just that newspapers aren't the only place to get it anymore. Newspapers have been in decline since the '50s, as it happens, and it was television news that competed with newspapers first, and radio news as well. And now, of course, it's the internet on top of that. So you know, this fragmentation has been going on a long time. I think you now have, you know, people complain a lot about media consolidation, and you know, as magazine editor, I'm like, I wish that were true. I wish I had less competition. I don't. I have a lot more. I don't really understand the media consolidation notion at all, because we have never had more media broadly defined than we have today. And I think in the political sphere that the rise of the political blogosphere is very much part of the political discourse, very much where people are going, because it has fresh voices who aren't afraid to speak their mind. But it's also leading to some, you know, to this polarization trend I talked about earlier. I mean, the left-wing blogosphere and the right-wing blogospheres are angry, polarized places. And if you only read one of them, you're going to get a very skewed version of the world. So I think these are early days yet. I think that, you know, that we hunger for fresh, authentic voices, and that's why we're kind of abandoning, you know, we're not abandoning, but we're moving away from traditional forms of political reportage, like newspapers, and towards the blogs. But I think this pendulum can swing too far. And you know, at the moment, I think that's leading us to become more polarized. Over time, I suspect people are going to realize that they do need to, you know, get a diversity of voices. They're going to read a wider range of blogs, and they will seek out the more responsible, more balanced, more rational voices. But it's not going to be that one institution does it for them. They're going to have to do it themselves. They're going to have to find that balance in their own reading habits rather than count on any one newspaper to provide it for them.
We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's do that. We'll go to a listener in Urbana next, line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, you were talking about how interests were becoming more tribal or small grouped. And from my perspective, as an old-time Wired reader from before Condé Nast, it seems to me that you're going in the other direction, that you're actually the person that you're warning us about.
Yeah, I am.
Because I remember when you came out with a list of the most Wired people, I don't know, 9 or 10 years ago, and they were all revolutionary individuals. And then you came out with another list on the cover sometime this year, a couple months ago. and they it was basically Google and Amazon and Apple.
Mm.
And
yeah.
You know, you're not bringing us the individual person that we didn't see. You have mentioned Google a dozen times, but you haven't mentioned the search engine we haven't tried yet.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You used
yeah.
to bring us the stuff that wasn't mainstream. Now you're out there, you're making Google richer with your radio show right here, instead of telling us about different places we could go instead of Google. You're making Apple richer by mentioning iTunes and all the places you can download 9 million iTunes, you know?
Minor point, we didn't mention iTunes, I don't think.
Yeah,
anyway.
We're talking about Walmart.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a fair point, and let me actually address this, because he's right. He's absolutely right. I have taken Wired more mainstream. Why have I done that? You know, why would I run counter to the theory? And the answer is that in 1993, when Wired was started, there was no web. There was no way to get information about this subculture called, you know, the digital revolution. I mean, you know, Wired was the only one, and so it very much was bringing news of a new subculture. What's changed is we've changed because the world's changed. That subculture is now the mainstream. There are not just one magazine to tell you about that. There are 27 million blogs. So, you know, the job of anybody in the media is to do something that adds value and is differentiated. You know, the world doesn't need us to tell them about niches. As a matter of fact, with a million readers, we can't tell them about every niche. We don't have enough pages, and they're not all interested in the same niches. Print is the wrong medium for that kind of hyper-narrow targeting of niche interests. And so as technology has gone mainstream, we've gone more mainstream as well. We're still focused on how technology is changing the world, but that's not Burning Man anymore. That's the iPod. That's TiVo. That's broadband. That's cell phones. That's the things that we all use. So we've sort of followed that path. Now, fortunately, we have another medium called the web, where we don't have to, we don't have to kind of conform to this somewhat mainstream mass market model. And there you do find us talking about, you know, the niche stuff there, because we have infinite shelf space. You'll find, and we actually just bought back our website a month ago, and we haven't evolved it as much as we will in our February relaunch. But you will see that we will have the very hyper narrow, the very bloggy, the very sort of peer production, user generated content, all that kind of stuff, because that's the right medium for that kind of niche targeting.
Okay.
Am I back on now?
Yes.
They cut me off before.
Well, we're getting short on time, so I want to include more callers too.
Well,
but go ahead.
Go ahead. To answer when he first said that in 1993, when Wired started, there wasn't the web. I hate to tell you, you're supposed to be the expert, but you and the web started at the same time.
Well, okay. Look, putting that aside, I was using the web in the late 80s and 89, because I was in the physics world, and you know, it was Gopher at the time, and then, you know, and the web started in physics, so we were using it from the beginning. What I mean is the web as a cultural phenomenon that most people weren't on. Remember that the web was a non-commercial the internet was a non-commercial medium, it was illegal to use it for commercial purposes until the early 90s. So what I mean to say is that There was none of the cultural phenomena that we now know of the web in the early 90s.
And I don't mean to cut off the callers, but we are growing short on time, and we've got some other people waiting, and I want to make sure we include as many people as possible. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign, line number 2. Good morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to say listening to you makes it's good to hear somebody championing all that, but I really wonder how realistic you are, because I think there's a political aspect to all of this that you seem to ignore. You act as if in a lot of these cases, it's kind of like a beauty contest where somebody has managed to get in early and then lock the door to all the other contestants, and there's a lot of that going on. I mean, they want to shut out this long tail, and they want to seem as if they're the leaders of opinion and the many, many other things. It even goes into arts. You talk about how one of those Indian blockbusters, Lagan, I think it was, or I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Only opened up in a few theaters. Well, I think the same thing about a lot of Hispanic films. et cetera. But as far as I think, if they were just following their dollar, their sense of what would make money, they would open up in more cases. But there's another aspect that's chilling the whole thing, and that's a political aspect. And I wish you'd speak a little bit more about that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
I'm actually not quite clear who the caller means by they. Who's chilling this? I actually can't answer the question unless I know that answer. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, if the caller would like to call back, we should have time. We have about maybe 5 or 6 minutes left. Chris Anderson is our guest. He's editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. We're talking about his book, The Long Tail: Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More. Well, there are a lot of things that we sort of touched upon in the time remaining. I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about the consumer as producer, because, you know, a lot of the tools that are available now, I mean, I produce digital audio and video, and it used to cost, you know, $500,000 to put together a studio, and now I've got one in my laptop, and the implications for this are kind of profound.
They are indeed. We talk about this as being the democratization of the tools of production.
Yeah.
You know, the old model was that, you know, you never pick a fight with someone who buys ink by the barrel, and, you know, the power of the press goes to those who own
right.
the press. We all own the press right now. You know, in every laptop you have, you know, most of the tools available for the entire music industry. You can record, mix, distribute, and market music, you know, with a laptop. And likewise for video. Look at YouTube. This extraordinary, you know, 100 million downloads a day, 65,000 uploads per day of new videos for free by amateurs of everything. Some of it is, you know, is exactly what you would expect, you know, home video stuff, and some of it is the kind of stuff that, you know, created the, you know, the OK Go music video phenomena, or
right.
the Lonely Girl 15 thing. You know, some of it's really, you know, it has audiences that are measured in the sort of same size as television audiences. It's really amazing, and it's happening because the tools to do it are in the hands of everybody. The tools of production and the tools of distribution are now in every computer. And what that means is you don't need to get your foot in the door in a Hollywood studio to make a movie. You don't need to get signed to a label to distribute music. And as a result, you're seeing a broader range of music and film, and to say nothing of text, where, you know, which has really been, you know, extraordinary blossoming there with blogs, et cetera. And I think it all stems from the fact that, you know, that individuals now have the power to say what they want without necessarily conforming to either commercial interests or anybody's rules whatsoever about what you want. Is, you know, most of it crap? Yeah, of course. You know, that's always what happens. But
well, most of the mainstream stuff is crap too, you know.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. But some of it's brilliant. And, you know, because of these powerful search tools, and I'm now required by the previous caller to mention a search engine other than Google, so, you know, Yahoo, if you will, you know, Ask Jeeves, whatever. Because of powerful search and recommendations, you can find those diamonds in the rough. You can find those new voices that are doing things that wouldn't have passed the commercial test, you know, in the old model. But now, because everything gets out there, can be found by other consumers, and with this, you know, extraordinary, you know, word of mouth effect, this meritocratic marketplace online, you know, the good stuff very quickly becomes a new kind of hit, a grassroots, bottoms up hit that can be every bit as popular as a commercial hit, but it's all done virtually for free.
We have just about 2 minutes left, and there's so much more we could talk about. There's one issue that I think a lot of people are grappling with. Well, you know, I don't really, you know, I don't use instant messaging, I don't text messages, a lot of these sort of information habits that we as baby boomers, at least myself, don't, it's not our natural habitat. I mean, I'm curious and I learn as much as I can, but a lot of people, and a lot of people older than me, are still struggling with how unnatural it seems, and they're not part of this information economy that's evolving. The same way as, for example, you begin the book with a snapshot in the life of a hypothetical teenager named Ben, whose consumer habits are vastly different than us
actually,
baby boomers.
Actually, not hypothetical. He's a real kid.
Okay, yeah. I mean, and, you know, this is something that is still kind of hard for many of us to fathom, the nature of this generational change.
Yeah. Well, I think you put your finger on it. It's generational. People think of the world and culture moving at the pace of technology, you know, Moore's Law and all that. The reality is that it doesn't. You know, culture and our society changes at a generational pace, which is to say that people don't change that quickly. People certainly don't change as quickly as technology changes. And what you find is that the reason that, you know, that everything's taking off right now in the so-called Web 2.0 era is not that the technologies are so radically different. In fact, there's almost nothing that were, you know, in Web 2.0 that wasn't talked about in our own pages in, you know, the mid-90s. What's different is that a generation that grew up online, that were sort of so-called digital natives who had broadband, who had IM, who basically used computers and the internet their entire, life, they've now come of age. And what's changing is the way they use the technology more than the technology itself. So I think that, you know, that when you talk about a generation that is not as comfortable with technology, I think realistically, they're probably never going to be fluent. They're probably never going to feel as comfortable as those who grew up with the technology. And that's why some of these things, you know, move more slowly than you would expect if you look at the technology itself, because people change slowly. So I suspect that the bad news is that this isn't going to happen overnight. The good news is that we're just at the beginning of what's going to be an extraordinary transformation of our culture once these generations that have grown up with this stuff really do come of age and start to let their feelings be known.
There we will leave it since we're here at the end of our time. The book is The Long Tail, Why the Future of Business is Selling Less of More, published by Hyperion just a month or so ago. The guest, Chris Anderson, who is the author of the book, editor-in-chief of Wired Magazine. Chris, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure.